Welcome to this mini-series of Data for What, the Development Gateway podcast. Over the course of four episodes, we will explore open data, data governance, and privacy, as well as the many challenges and opportunities within these topics. I'm your host, Beverly Hatrimbu. In this episode, our guests will walk us through laws and regulations. We'll be specifically talking about data protection in Kenya and India. We'll be discussing how to consider how much control citizens have over their data and the importance of implementation of laws to protect access. We'll talk through if countries' demographics and history can and should impact their approach to data governance. And note that this podcast was recorded a little while ago, so some things have changed a bit. I still think that some of the themes that we discussed at that time are very timely because it's still not clear that many of the items that we got to address together through our conversation have shown up in this current version of the data privacy law in India as it stands. So I hope, even though you're hearing this in the future, that you'll find the conversation interesting in terms of some of the key trade-offs that data protection laws, not only in Kenya and India, but globally, some of the key considerations that countries need to be thinking about. Without further ado, let's get right to it. We've got two fabulous guests with us, but I'll let them introduce themselves. Dr. Melissa Umino, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you and what brought you to our chat today.
Thank you so much, Beverly. Thank you for having me. As you have rightly stated, my name is Dr. Melissa Umino, and I am the acting director at the Center of Intellectual Property and Information Technology Law at Strathmore University, otherwise known as CIPET. We have several centers under CIPET. One of them is the Data Protection or Data Governance Center, where we look at policy around data governance and data protection regulation and laws in the African region and obviously within Kenya. We do have a podcast known as the Friendly Troll Podcast at CIPET, where we discuss matters of data protection. So it's great to be a guest and not hosting.
Thanks so much, Melissa. I love the name Friendly Troll, and I also love your content. So it's nice to be able to play trades. And certainly, last but not least, we have Srija Sen. Tell us why you're here. What brings you to this chat?
Again, thank you so much for having me here. It's great to be able to talk to you and Melissa. I am Srija. I am a researcher with IT for Change. We are a Bangalore-based civil society organization, Bangalore, India, of course. And I engage with issues of data governance and the digital economy, as well as ways of regulating corporate power within the larger ambit of all of IT for Change's work.
Thanks so much, Srija. So Dr. Umino, in a few words, what do you mean in the Kenyan context when you say data protection? What does it mean to protect and govern data in Kenya?
I don't think many people see a distinction, but there clearly is one. So in Kenya, data protection is concerned with ensuring the privacy of Kenyan citizens and the data of Kenyan citizens in particular. So this regime is anchored in the right to privacy as envisioned by the Constitution of Kenya. To this end, there are different categories of data under the Data Protection Act, which was enacted in 2019, about data of an individual and how that can be handled by processes and controllers. Data governance, however, refers more towards setting standards through policies that would determine how data would be governed. And the Data Protection Act forms an arm under the data governance landscape. So data governance policies can be sectorial based. So for example, based around agriculture or health. And we do know that the Kenya government is working on policies in those areas. And these are just taking strides towards identifying better structures for the protection of data.
Sometimes data protection, data governance sort of get used a little bit interchangeably, but really data protection is a small piece of the larger governance whole. And I know that this resonates with you, Srija, because the work that you guys do at IT for Change is broad in terms of bringing in different sectors. So what do data protection and data governance mean for you in India?
I think in the Indian context at the present time, it's very interesting to talk about data protection because historically, I would say data protection has been about safeguarding personal information. But we would be remiss if we don't consider the now withdrawn data protection bill, which also included non-personal data within its ambit. But I think within our limited construct at this point, without a legislation to back it up, we have to look at data protection from the perspective perspective of privacy. And for that, we have the 2017, you know, seminal Indian Supreme Court decision of K.S. Puttaswamy versus Union of India, which held that privacy is a fundamental right and not a narrow band right, but an expansive right of privacy, which includes informational privacy, physical privacy, and decisional privacy. And also there are existing rules in place, rules that were laid down in 2011 within the ambit of the Information Technology Act that we have in place, and which sort of safeguards sensitive personal information, which includes financial information, medical records, biometric information, and such. Given that the legal scenario for us is a little bit in flux, so we will see some movement in terms of what data protection is legally defined as for India in the next few months.
Thanks, Shreeja. That's really helpful. And this is a good segue to return to you, Dr. Amina. In Kenya, you have a law as well as a newly formed Data Protection Commission. What features make both the law and the commission tailored to ensure governance really works in the domestic Kenyan context? What features do you see as still missing from the regulatory environment?
This is really a controversial question, or the answer might change depending on who you talk to. For myself, I think that the fact that the data protection regime in Kenya is anchored in the right to privacy really does make for a solid foundation. So we do have the Data Protection Act that was enacted in 2019, and it came in at quite an opportune time because then we all experienced COVID in 2020, and there was a lot of movement online, and with it, a lot of collection of data. So the act firmly identifies data protection principles and minimum standards that are to be adhered to in the business of processing and controlling of the data of the citizens of Kenya. However, the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner only became operationalized in November of 2020, because that's when the commissioner, the data commissioner, was appointed. And that was a step in the right direction. But the question really has been, what happens towards implementation of the act via the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner? And a lot has been said and is still being said about the capacity of that office, the independence of that office, as well as questions around how well staffed it is in order to address the issues that the Data Protection Act is supposed to look over. So as much as the Office of the Commissioner has been part of bringing into place the flesh that builds up the DPA, which is basically the skeleton in regards to the data protection regime, they were assisted by a task force in drafting the regulations that came out earlier this year. And that was another controversy in itself. And the task force was appointed by the cabinet secretary in the ministry that oversees the Data Protection Commissioner's office. Now, that in itself calls into question the independence of the commissioner, because the commissioner is meant to also not just regulate the private sector, but government as well. So these are some of the gaps that I would say currently exist, even though the framework really is a wonderful framework. Implementation is always the devil, right? The devil as in the details of getting this framework operationalized. Some of the other gaps that have been mentioned are what the data subject, meaning the citizen, is meant to do in order to obtain relief through the provisions of the act. So for example, there are a plethora of forms that a data subject must fill out to restrict processing of their personal data, to object to processing of personal data, to request access even, or to request rectification. Now, this means that most of the citizenry would need to be educated on, as to what these forms say and how to fill out the forms and where to get the forms. And that's a whole animal in itself. There is a belief that this process could have been simplified rather than expecting the data subject to fill in quite a number of forms. Thirdly, who's supposed to explain the forms to the data subject? Is the data processor and controller supposed to do that when the data subject is asking to restrict the processing of their personal data? There's a conundrum there. There's also the feeling that the regulations are quite basic and will not adequately deal with current and future developments, especially when we talk about artificial intelligence, the metaverse, or the digital economy. So that's something that would need to be developed as technology develops. And I think we'll get to that later on. But there's also confusion with regards to what a data protection policy is vis-a-vis a privacy notice or a privacy policy. And the office would maybe have done well to explain the distinction in these two. So yeah, there's a real need for more guidelines and issues of compliance guidelines as well. And a demonstration from the Data Protection Commissioner's office that they are truly independent from the mother ministry.
Now, shifting a little bit deeper into the regulatory environment, I think you both touched on really the impact to people, the impact to the data owners and users. In India and in Kenya, it's hard to talk about data governance without touching on the impact of data collection, and particularly this part of digital identification systems. In Kenya, you have the Huduma Namba, while in India, you have the Aadhaar system. And this is a very specific example that mass data collection isn't only around digital ID. So can you both touch on the impact or not of both your various legal and regulatory environments on these drivers of citizen data collection? And feel free to use a non-digital ID example if that makes sense for you.
The regulation of data collected from under the Aadhaar project is regulated with the Aadhaar Act of 2016. While it is a law which sort of regulates how targeted delivery of financial and other subsidies, benefits, etc. happens, and that's what the Aadhaar project seeks to do, the regulation of the data within it seems to have what we understand as the regular understanding of the data protection lifecycle. So within the Aadhaar Act, a governance of the data, which is largely biometric information, is regulated through the 2011 Sensitive Personal Information Rules. The data is also stored in a central identities repository, and the law restricts sharing of core biometric information, which includes like fingerprint or iris scan, at all times. Citizens are able to, you know, seek changes in their demographic information, which includes their name, date of birth, phone number, address, and so on. But the key issue, of course, that we continue to grapple with, and I think this sort of is an issue of the digital identity system or the move towards digital or further digitalization, is that for us, the issue is often infrastructural. A lot happens through a one-time password or an OTP, which is generated and sent to the data principal's phone number. That is in order to like authenticate your identity and so on. But sometimes these OTPs don't arrive in time because of low connectivity, especially in peri-urban or rural conditions. There's also the critique on the central data repository as well, which is like, if it's a single point of failure for all of data that of they hold of all of the citizens, then it's very easy to sort of breach that single barrier. However, I think from a data protection perspective, it will, once we do have a law, we can expect some clarifications on who will be the governing authority in case of all of this data. So currently, because the Aadhaar Act governs all of this, the governing authority is the Unique Identification Authority of India, or the UIDAI as it's called. And that authority deals with any potential breach or illegal publication of all of this data. But in case a data protection authority is put in place, would citizens be able to reach this authority under the Data Protection Bill? Or would they have to be still regulated under the Aadhaar Act? So these are questions that I think will be resolved once we have a law, and questions that we need to engage with at that point. The other issue of this large-scale data collection is that we don't know who is using it and for whose benefit. And if there is monetization of data, and especially if they are anonymized, and then the aggregate non-personal data, who is using it for whose benefit, those kind of questions are still not being asked. Or even if they are being asked, they're not being answered. So yeah, those are issues I think we generally see with this kind of large data collection.
Then, Dr. Amino, on your side, how is the conversation evolving around Huduma Namba?
Well, with a lot of controversy, I would say.
It seems to be a theme.
The Huduma Namba is actually the unique identification number that would be a result of the National Integrated Identity Management System. And that was basically very similar to Aadhaar, which was, it's meant to integrate all forms of identification of citizens into this one unique system. And so you don't have to have a national ID like we currently have. And then later on, you get your PIN number. And then later on, you get all sorts of different numbers for different government services, which is supposed to centralize this. And it's quite interesting to see the reaction around Huduma number within, for example, civil society and the fintech sector. So civil society has from the jump been up in arms about Huduma number because of its introduction, I would say. This is my opinion. I think its introduction was more of, this is mandatory. And as citizens, you don't have a say. Government sort of said, this is what we are doing. And you have to do it within this time. And we are collecting all this data. Now, the key point is that this was happening even before the Data Protection Act came into being, although there were several bills about data protection that had been floating about, but had not yet been assented to. So the question was, with all this data that's being collected under this one system, what are the measures that government is taking to ensure that the data will not be breached and to ensure that there will not be any discriminatory practices, because there's so much that was being collected? And the answer was, if you do not participate in this, then you will not be able to vote or you will not be able to receive government services. And that's why the civil society were really up in arms. And not only were they up in arms, they did something about it, such that they went to court about Huduma number. But mostly they went to court to say that there was a question around its compliance with the Data Protection Act that came into play after the NIMS system was put in place. Now, the court found that a data protection impact assessment with regard to that system ought to be carried out retrospectively. It found that the act, because it's based on the constitution, can be seen to have existed before its enactment, which is an interesting argument, and maybe also interesting interpretation depending on who you speak to. So that was quite controversial, but in a positive light, if you look at it through the lens of data protection. And DPIA was indeed carried out over Huduma number, but even the quality of the DPIA is a controversial issue. And there were so many questions that then came up about the role of courts in dissolving disputes arising out of data protection themed complaints vis-a-vis the role of the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner. And also the question around how the definition of a data subject might affect the adjudication of such complaints, because it was a civil society body together with one of the most prominent legal scholars who brought this case to the High Court. And the court said it has jurisdiction over the matter. And it said that even though the civil society body was not necessarily a data subject as envisioned by the Data Protection Act, they could still bring in such a complaint. And the data subject who brought it to the court could still seek recourse from the courts, even though there could have been a first complaint to the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner. So we are finding ourselves in a space that's more confused than when we first began. But sentiments around Huduma number are different within the fintech space. Recently, there was a conversation about the plethora of apps that allow services to consumers who are data subjects and how it would be so easy for them to provide these services without feeling exposed, because if they had a digital ID system, it would be easy to follow up with the consumers who are making use of that service. And that was quite interesting to hear, but obviously knowing where the interests of that sector lies, it might not be surprising. But on the general scale, there was a lot of resistance towards the digital ID, and even the fintech space acknowledged that there was resistance. And their answer to this was probably there should be more positives about digital ID explained, and also how controllers and processors would work towards safeguarding the data that is held within the digital ID system. It's a bridge we have not yet crossed in terms of this controversy, but it really makes great jurisprudence around the interaction between data protection and digital ID, which I think makes the field richer and we can refine details.
In both India and Kenya, respectively, what are you seeing as the alternatives for genuine engagement of citizens with their data during all of these digital processes?
I don't know if if there is a genuine engagement with the citizenry about control of their own data, I feel like in the existing framework within, especially like the Aadhaar Act, I mean, there is scope for citizens to seek changes in their demographic information, but the law sort of terms it as requests to make changes, and then the authority will make those changes if it's satisfied with the request. So the language is framed in a way where the authority sort of is already placed at a higher level.
The onus is on citizens to make it. That seems to be a theme that I'm hearing from both of you.
Yes. And they can seek a record of their data updation history as well as their authentication history. But there isn't scope to delete their data if they so want, which usually is a very intrinsic part of this data lifecycle that we speak of. There is collection, there is storage, there's retention, there is deletion or archival, wherever it goes. But there isn't really a scope for deletion for the Aadhaar system in any case. In a sense, still we have a data protection law which sort of addresses this. This data is held in perpetuity. And even in like earlier drafts, I would say, certain data is held with the government in perpetuity. So I don't know if that will be resolved with a law coming in, but again, remains to be seen. Like you said, the onus ends up being on the citizen in a place where we have so much asymmetry in the digital access and literacy. It really affects how one can assert one's rights. So where I can go to a bank and ask for my data to be updated, someone else may not have those tools to do that. And when, you know, you've collected data to the tune of a billion citizens, it really is a question as to how you're resolving any further issues that come up with that data. Because Aadhaar exclusions have always been an issue. And because Aadhaar is linked to basic services of ration like rice and things like that, these are questions that need to be engaged with continuously. And, you know, there are several activists who continue to do that.
Melissa, what alternatives are you seeing in terms of really opening the door or widening the door for citizens to be able to manage and own their own data?
Alternatives, I think, especially when you're talking about the implementation of digital ID, or where you're talking about a citizen versus government and protection of personal data against a government entity, is quite a huge question that I'm not quite sure how to answer. I do know, for example, in Kenya, we do have the right to erasure, or the right to be forgotten is within the Data Protection Act, but it's not an absolute right. It's a limited right, and it's limited to certain circumstances, for example, where data is inaccurate or outdated or incomplete, also where there's no longer authorization to retain the data according to the various principles that are within the Act, and whether it's excessive data or obtained unlawfully. But implementing that right, again, as has already been stated, means that the onus is on the data subject, and the data subject has to request that any of these is done, or the data is rectified or removed because of any of these reasons. The ability of a data subject to understand these, looking at the demographic of Kenya, is questionable. And at the same time, even the political climate or the temperature in terms of how Huduma Namba was rolled out didn't really give people the confidence that even as this data is being collected, there could be in the future the ability to rectify or say what is excessive against government. And that's a question about politics and power that maybe we'll have later on. Now, there are regulations that deal with civil registration under the Data Protection Act, and it talks about lawful processing of personal data, or rather the data protection principles that are there. It also talks about the rights of a data subject, for example, the right to access personal data, rectify data portability requests, and the obligation that civil registration entities have towards data subjects. But it's, as I said, the crux of the matter always falls within implementation. You can have a wonderful skeleton or framework, but how is it implemented? And I I don't know about alternatives, because especially with regards to government services, it's something that in the history of this country has been, you endure because you need the service, especially if you don't have the monetary means to probably seek a different service, if we're talking about healthcare, for example. And sometimes there is no other alternative service. So that's where civil society comes in, and they have so far done a wonderful job. And hopefully the litigious nature of these civil society practitioners will help to further refine. But looking at the data subject or the citizen as an individual, that's a really, really tall hill to climb.
These challenges that we're discussing are not just in the digital ID space. Indian authorities will need to look at enforcing data governance across sectors, particularly in health and agriculture. At DG, we've seen in our own work, the health sector tends to have more data governance because there's a lot more primary data collection involved versus agriculture, which has next to nothing around governance structures. But there is a clear need. The more and more you see data being collected from farmers for all of these new digital agriculture apps. So what do you think, Sridhar, are the critical issues Indian authorities will need to grapple with in order for the Data Protection Bill or really any other framework of laws to enforce a privacy-forward data governance culture across sectors?
I want to start off by saying that just looking at it from a privacy lens can be limiting. This is never to distance from the fact that we do need a law in India, but like the economic value of data is slowly being recognized globally. And even, you know, global north countries or regions like the EU have sort of recognized the value in this and have come up with things like the common data spaces to ensure, you know, data collection and use across the board. In India, we've seen similar structures created throughout across sectors. In health, we have the Ayushman Bharat Digital Mission, which sets up the digital health infrastructure in the country. And similarly, for agriculture, we also have something which is the Indian Digital System of Agriculture, or the AgriStack, to enhance digitalization in agriculture. These two have varied levels of regulatory structures. We've also seen vast leaps in the financial sector with the establishment of the unique payments interface, which has enabled payments through one's phone. So more or less, like, a lot of payments across the board and across services have become digitalized. And that seems to be something that India has done before a lot of other countries. In terms of the health, the digital health infrastructure, they've come up with their own set of regulations, and these are in their developing stages: data retention, you know, data management, who will be the governing authority. You know, there is a digital health ID that has been associated with this, which is separate from the Aadhaar, but similar in that it is a number which will be the portal to all of your health data history and can be used across different hospitals and health facilities and so on. On the agriculture side, there's the push towards a farmer's database, creating digitalized land records and things like that. So I think the questions that we have to consider for data governance across all of these areas is what happens to the vast amounts of transactions data, for example, that are collected through a UPI gateway. A UPI gateway, we have a bunch of them. A large number of them are owned by private companies. Google has one, which is called Google Pay. There is one called Phone Pay. All of these companies are collecting vast amounts of transactions data across citizens. So what happens to that? How does one safeguard against exclusions that can arise from creating a farmer's database, which is based on these digitalized land records, or the requirement of a digital health ID for accessing healthcare records through the Ayushman Bharat program? How do we fix asymmetries in digital access and basic infrastructural concerns? What kind of consent frameworks can be instituted in these sectors? And what does informed consent mean for a farmer or a patient using government services? Like Melissa said, who is going to explain a long privacy policy of a company to them, or if they're using an app, or will it be in a language that they understand? Because a large number of these policies are in English, not in their regional language. So then that creates an automatic barrier to, you know, accessing that information. I mean, and also questions like if aggregate data is being monetized, who benefits? Like, are we ending up giving all of this data to big tech companies who anyway are now the size of countries rather than anything else. So yeah, these are questions that, you know, we have to continue to engage with now.
You've really pulled out some of the key challenges and also the key opportunities to make these more robust governance systems. The building blocks are there. So I'm going to pivot a little bit to Melissa. You touched on this earlier on, and I wanted to come back to it, that one of the gaps you see in Kenya's current regulatory environment is the lack of adaptability facing new trends and technologies. What are some of the things that you're seeing maybe among civil society or others in terms of preparing for new technologies like artificial intelligence and others, in terms of what that means for governance and protection of data?
While I had this conversation with a friend who's an expert in the field about if they feel that the Data Protection Act in Kenya would easily cope with, for example, a new breaking technology appearing in the next 1 or 2 years. And his sentiments were that would take a lot of build-up in capacity in the Office of the Data Protection Commissioner, and it would also need a little bit of revamping of the Data Protection Act. And his gripe especially was with the categories of data within the Act, and he felt that this was limiting because how we categorize data now is based on the technology that we know of and understand now. This means that with new technology and new ways of collecting data and processing and doing all these things would mean new categories of data that would need to be added onto the Data Protection Act for compliance by data protection processors and controllers. Now, what is happening in this space, I think it really points towards the work that CIPET does. We look at the cross-section of AI, intellectual property, and data protection. So we are really trying to look at do a horizon scan and determine what would be the emerging areas that would need to be addressed. We are also looking at the AI ecosystem in the African context and what that means, because there's this idea that open data vis-a-vis data protection and the stifling of innovation, and we're trying to dismantle that type of thinking. Of course, there's this element of open data, and even the Kenyan government is a proponent of open data, but there's also the issue of the protection of personal data and how these two can coexist together. Also, the fact that certain areas have not been regulated doesn't automatically mean that is the advantage of open data. It just means that the legal and regulatory framework was working to catch up to it. And that means that we have to go take a step back and look at even basic education that's happening, where we can not only push for the development of STEM within our education system, but also push for the development of legal education to move to far beyond the traditional confines that it is, and have somebody who studies STEM and who studies the law and who studies policy at the same time, so that we can have this crop of individuals who would be better equipped to deal with the fast-paced moving world. It's really interesting to also witness how trade is playing quite a big role in pushing innovations and pushing interoperability, for example, but could also be said to be stifling the regulations around what trade is pushing. If you look at many data protection regulations and frameworks, they often have an exception that says that any of these protections should not impede trade. And then it becomes quite an interesting conversation. So I would say that all this boils down to a capacity building within the offices of those who regulate data protection, but also capacity building in the minds of innovators to really understand what data protection is. The grounding of privacy is really a good thing, but also to educate them that the existence of data protection does not mean the absence of open data. There is a balance there.
This is one of the questions that I am the most curious about, because I come from a country that is diverse in religion, ethnicity, and geographic spread. And that is very much how I think many people would define Kenya and India, respectively. You have populations that often hold strong, often competing group identities, to put it, you know, diplomatically. This to me is distinct from some of the other countries who are discussing governance and data protection from a very individual focused approach to the law and its enforcement, because they don't have that layer of context necessarily to contend with. Do you think that these features of how your nations were thrown together, gur colonialism, could or should have an impact on how your countries approach data governance?
Colonialism, I don't know if I am qualified to scratch that beast, but I will keep to the sort of contextual understanding of data protection that sort of India has engaged with. And I think it is key to move beyond the individualized form of data protection that is the standard at present and is a very, I would say, global north creation. Depending on the type of data, governance frameworks have to evolve. And as such, considering the vast amounts of data collected by digital platforms and the kind of tailored advertisements and services they are able to provide, I mean, digital platforms have access to the social and economic behavior of several different groups of people, whether you cut it age-wise or by gender or through any other marker, like you mentioned. I mean, India's report on non-personal data from the Committee of Experts was set up by the government, where one of our directors was a member, has devised a community data standard or community data protection regime, which is more of a sui generis regime, which seeks to provide data rights for these groups, where you can't identify one data principle, but there are rights that you need to protect for, and the benefits that you derive out of this data need to be shared. So in a sense, this framework talks about how, and if this is similar to the Nagoya Protocol over traditional knowledge and things like that, a community's right over the resources associated with it, the community's consent for use of such resources, which in this case is data, benefit sharing from those resources that, you know, companies end up using, and community participation in governance of these resources. So I feel like the issue of non-personal data or aggregate data has not really been addressed as much. While we talk a lot about personal data in terms of, like, when we talk about data governance and we talk about personal data as being sacrosanct, there is a lot that can be derived simply out of even anonymized and aggregate data. If you take a group of 20 to 25 year old women in, say, Bangalore, you can tell a lot about that group because of the kinds of services they're using online, because of the kinds of associations they have across not just political lines, but their personal groups and things like that. So this is data that digital platforms are constantly collecting, and they need to be addressed in some way. And the non-personal data governance regime is one such way. And we need to move towards a place where we can consider data as some sort of a commons, which is available for everyone to use and benefit from, rather than being siloed and, you know, walled by these private companies.
Melissa, over to you.
I really love what Rija has said, even calling upon the Nagoya Protocol. I think that's really interesting, but I'm probably going to put a little spin on your question. If I look at Kenya and a study, well, Kenya, Africa, and a study that we did recently at CIPET looking at data governance on the continent, there was this particular place we had to take a pause and ask ourselves, especially about digital ID and the construction of what personal data means and the identification or categories of what personal data is, and looking at it at the context of the indigenous communities. First of all, it was glaringly obvious that these are very much Eurocentric concepts. And looking at the Nubians, for example, in Kenya, who have taken the government to task on issues of Huduma number, for example, it's clear that they are excluded from the word go to this regime of protection because they were historically excluded from even national identity cards. For example, they don't have that. They don't have access to that. There are questions around who is a Kenyan and what makes you Kenyan, if not a birth certificate or national ID, when that conflicts greatly with traditional communities and how they identify each other and claim each other through more oral traditions rather than written materials that say when and where you are born and who your mother and father are. And yet that is the very essence of where data protection as we know it begins. So then it really upends this whole idea of data protection in the African context. Does it make sense in the African context? And when I think further, we talk about harmonization or interoperability between different countries for the sake of trade. And here I am hinting towards the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, where there will be a protocol on digital trade and would have provisions of data protection. Does it make sense for us to build this up other than to ensure that we continue participating in a very Eurocentric system to make money, etc.? So when I look at it that way, maybe data protection and data governance might not make sense towards what would be truly the African context or the Kenyan context to these communities that we're talking about. But it starts to make sense when we talk about accessibility to services and we start to talk about the ability to be part of society in terms of how they make money, how they get education, how they take care of their bodies. Then we need to deconstruct where the root of data protection begins and really think about the person as inherently having an identity that doesn't have to be identified by a Eurocentric system. And then they have also the autonomy to say how that identity and whatever is connected to it will be monetized or utilized as long as it is for their benefit. But even putting this idea out there to those who might not have interrogated this question seems very outlandish. But I'm really glad that SIPIT got to ask ourselves like what data justice is in the context of data governance. Because if we are saying that we are rooting all this in the right to privacy or a human right, then we have to look at the injustices that have occurred that really splits open this conversation outside the confines of just a legal regulatory framework, outside the confines of a tech conversation, but towards looking at social issues that maybe we have not been taking cognizance of.
There is so much to love in both of your answers. I think they framed this conversation so well. You both have been incredible guests. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise, what you're grappling with, where you're seeing strengths, where you're seeing opportunities for growth. Before you leave today, I have one last question that I like to ask because I always get great answers on this. What are you both reading, watching, or listening to that's helping you dive further into some of the stuff we've talked about today?
I love to read. I really, really love to read, but I try to stay away from reading about what I do in my day job.
Fair.
Because I do so much reading. So I just finished reading About Love by Bell Hook.
Ooh. That's a favorite. I love that book.
I love it. I'm buying it for everybody I know who hasn't read it. You would be deceived by the title that, you know, it's about like, you know, mushy romantic love, but the way the book is structured really does help me when I'm thinking about my 9-to-5 work, because it talks about community, it talks about justice, it talks about work and your love for work and how you should navigate that while also having a work-life balance. I have been listening to For Colored Nerds. I love that podcast. It's really interesting. And I've also been listening to the Spotify playlist on the top hits in Kenya.
I love all of this. Shreeja, how about you?
I think after Melissa's answer, I will sound extremely boring.
No way.
But I wanted to talk about this paper that I was reading, or at least started reading, which is the case for establishing a collective perspective to address harms of platform personalization. It talks to something we already discussed, which is, you know, the individualistic notions of personal data and how they're insufficient to address harms in the data ecosystem. And I've also started to sort of engage with worker data, right? So I was reading a little bit to understand a little more about how algorithmic management and, you know, that kind of stuff affect, you know, workers' data, right? So there's a paper on algorithms at work, the new contested terrain of control. So that seems to be something that I think will help me understand a little more about how this works. I binge watch a lot, so I've been catching up on The Good Wife. And yes, that's what I've been up to.
Ooh, I love both of your recommendations. All of the things. I'm like, I love Bell Hooks. I love, love, love The Good Wife. I love the things that more broadly, both the academic papers, but then also the pop culture items that help you think about not only the issues that we're working on, but sort of our positioning in the world. On my side, my answer is a little bit nerdy this particular week, but I just started reading AI 2041. So they're fictional stories set in different countries and contexts, looking at some of the ways in which AI could be used in future, and then followed up by essays contextualizing what the fictional stories present. And it's nice. It's a happy medium between fiction, my love of fiction, and then also like grappling with some of these larger issues. Thank you both so incredibly much for being so generous with your time and with your insights.
Special thanks to our guests, and thanks to our producers behind the scenes, Lindsay Fincham, Annalisa Goodman, and Becca Warner. This episode was produced by Lindsay Fincham and edited by Annalisa Goodman. Our theme music was created by Mark Hatcher. Learn more about Development Gateway and IRX Venture on our website at developmentgateway.org or through our social media.